Back on Sunday, the Kansas City Chiefs did something that they've done 7 games in a row now. They won. But at home against the San Diego Chargers, it was sloppy, it was ugly, it was scary at the end, which reminds me of a game that happened a few weeks prior that the Kansas City Chiefs lost. You can look at that. You'll get so much more on this episode of Roughing the Kicker here on Arrowhead Addict. I'm your host, Joshua Briscoe. On Twitter, at JB Briscoe. If you have questions, comments, ideas, you can tweet them to me there. We will talk about that victory. We will preview the Ravens game where the Chiefs will be playing on Sunday. Also going to look at a bunch of other issues like Ja Reed's new contract, Justin Houston's knee injury, the updates that have come there. We'll talk about Dee Ford's big game and how much we should be buying into Dee Ford as the future. I think we're going to need to pull back a little bit on that. But we're going to lead off the show here with some discussion about the comeback player of the year. I asked some of you on Twitter, what should we talk about on this show that isn't just game recap, game preview? And a couple of you responded by saying comeback player of the year and the idea that Eric Berry might end up losing the award to Adrian Peterson, as was suggested on NFL.com. I saw this article right when it came out, but it didn't really register with me how much of an issue Chiefs fans took with it until Ty Declare and Christine Roadlander at TyDeclare44 and C. Roadlander on Twitter responded to me with that question of what else should we talk about on this show. Chris Wesseling on NFL.com put together a top 10 comeback player of the year candidates list for the top 10 candidates for comeback player of the year. I'm not going to bother going through the whole list because we only care about a few of the names, but number 5 is Larry Fitzgerald, number 4 is Brandon Marshall. Both good stories, both good comebacks, but let's stick on the top 3 here. At number 3, he has Eric Berry, noting obviously, quote, "There isn't a better story than Berry's successful return from Hodgkin's lymphoma. So this 26 years old, Berry has regained Pro Bowl form for a team that has a chance to close out the season riding a 10-game winning streak." And then he notes some things. If Berry wins the award, dot, dot, dot. Doesn't really matter. Obviously, Eric Berry is the best story in the NFL this year. And I would argue he is the second best combination of story and performance and importance. I'll get to number one, though. But my number one person on the list is not Adrian Peterson. He has Adrian Peterson at number 2. And I want you to listen to this for just a moment and note the difference between Eric Berry, the other player, and Adrian Peterson. Quote, "Peterson has bounced back in resounding fashion after missing the final 15 games last year, flashing 2012 MVP form in recent games versus the Raiders and Falcons. Peterson is currently leading the league in rushing attempts, rushing yards per game, rushing touchdowns, and yards from scrimmage. And if he maintains those leads, it'll be the first time sweeping those 5 categories in a stellar career that will someday lead to a bust in Canton." And then his number one player, Carson Palmer, it begins with 13 months after tearing his ACL for a second time, Palmer is giving Cam Newton and Tom Brady a serious run for the MVP award. He's 35, torn his ACL twice. Adrian Peterson's blurb there didn't mention why he missed those last 15 games. And you could very justifiably argue, and I think I did argue last year, that Peterson did not need to miss those 15 games, but the Vikings were afraid of the PR backlash if he played after photos came out of like switch wounds on his 4-year-old child's legs. That's different. That is different. And again, if you don't think he should have missed the last 15 games, that's fine. I think the Vikings were scared. I think the NFL is scared after Ray Rice and the video that came out there. Think everyone was horrified of some video coming out. Whatever. You can take that as an aside. But Adrian Peterson wasn't a victim. Adrian Peterson did a bad thing where there were pictures, because that's the world we live in. Pictures came out, and he did not play the rest of the season after that happened. Okay, I don't care about your fantasy team. I don't care about if you think he should have played or not. For the idea of this comeback player of the year award. If Peterson would have torn his ACL again, If he would have had cancer, however you want to... The comeback player of the year is one of the most subjective awards in football. It's truly... And I'm not typically caught up on things like this, but comeback player of the year award is so subjective because it's about performance and story. It's about the return of a player from some sort of adversity. Adrian Peterson brought his adversity on himself. If you want to defend his right to discipline his 4-year-old child, fine. I mean, we're probably going to disagree. If that's the first thing you think of, we're probably going to disagree. That's okay. I'm okay with that. But if you're also going to argue that the fact that he was sat down by the Vikings, again, because the Vikings were scared, not because the Vikings were being particularly noble, he got paid through that season. If you're going to argue that should put him ahead of either Eric Berry or Carson Palmer for comeback player of the year. I don't get it. I don't understand. If you want to call him offensive player of the year and you don't want to give that award to a quarterback, fine. That's fine. If you want to say Eric Berry should not be defensive player of the year, I would agree with you. If you don't think Eric Berry is the best safety in football, I would agree with you. But Eric Berry has had a very, very good season, a Pro Bowl level season. And it's a year after coming back from having lymphoma. The story there is incredible. And personally, I think I would actually vote for Carson Palmer first as comeback player of the year, because he tore his ACL again for a second time and is now playing at an MVP level on a very, very, very good team at the quarterback position. It's the most important thing you can do in football, is be the quarterback of a very good team and a very good offense. If Carson Palmer wins it, Chiefs fans, don't be upset at that. Don't tweet the NFL and go, I can't believe you didn't have Eric Berry win this award. Calm down. But if Adrian Peterson, you think, is the deserving comeback player of the year because he missed 15 games because the Vikings didn't want to play him after pictures came out of wounds on the legs of his child, of his 4-year-old, of his 4-year-old, and that's why he missed those 15 games, we're on different pages. That's not the comeback player of the year. That's a very, very good player who missed 15 games because he played for a scared organization after he did a bad thing and then came back and played very, very well again after a year of rest. If you want to pretend the comeback player of the year award is story related at all, which is the entire point, I think, you're either giving it to the quarterback on one of the best teams in football coming back from injury for a second time, or you're giving it to one of the premier safeties who's going to go to the Pro Bowl, who crushed cancer in an unbelievably short period of time and came back to football incredibly quickly. Not to the guy who got indicted on charges of child abuse and then had a really great season after that. Again, you could argue to me that Adrian Peterson should be the offensive player of the year. And that's, you could argue it. Please, go for it. I'm totally willing to hear that argument. He's one of the best running backs of this generation. He might be the best running back of this generation. But that's not about a comeback. We're talking about a comeback. Okay, Carson Palmer beat the odds. Eric Berry beat cancer. Adrian Peterson beat his kid. Okay, football. 10-3, the Chiefs beat the Chargers at home. I don't think anyone expected this to be a 10-3 game. There were no scores in the first or fourth quarter, which was very odd. The Chargers got their 3 points in the third quarter. The Chiefs got their 10 points in the second. It was the first time the Chargers had been shut out, I think, since 2003, when the Chiefs also were the team that shut them out. First quarter, the Chiefs started by forcing a 3-and-out. The first tackle of the game was by Dee Ford on a Melvin Gordon run, which I think was telling. I would have expected before the game that the Chargers would try to run at Dee Ford early and try to figure out if they could run right at Dee Ford, because that's one of the weaknesses of his game. And the Chargers, though, one of their weaknesses has been running the ball, so that did not really work in their favor. But the Chargers went to challenge him early. 3rd-and-1 attempt was stopped by Josh Malga. But there were some hidden mistakes right away for the Chiefs that ultimately, I think, could have cost the Chiefs the game, because they had these several times, not just in penalties, but a huge Frankie Hammond punt return was undone by a Steven Nelson block in the back, and holding on Brian Parker killed a 15-yard run by Spencer Ware. Those are things where it's not just seeing the penalty yardage, but also understanding the additional yardage that it costs. It's not just that it moved them back X number of yards, so that it cost them a big punt return or 15 yards from Spencer Ware. 3rd-and-3, tossed a few yards back to Tre'Kendrick West, ate it for a loss of 6. I hate those. Whenever it's 3rd-and-short, please don't let the first move be backwards. But on the first drive, Jeremy Maclin was 4-for-38, which is awfully interesting. No points, though. Dustin Colquitt punts it to inside of the 10, plus a half the distance to the goal penalty, and then the Chargers get the ball back. I'm going to try to spare you the gory details for a lot of this game because it was ugly and there weren't a lot of scores. But the Chargers don't do anything, and it looks like Frankie Hammond has a good lane and some speed to return the punt on the punt return, but a Charger gets his hand on the ball. It flips out. The Chargers get the ball on the 26-yard line on the Frankie Hammond fumble. I was shocked that Frankie Hammond saw the field again after that, but he did plenty of times. And the Chargers get to 3rd-and-8. Tama gets major pressure. Field goal for the Chargers, but Josh Lambeau, their kicker, goes wide left from 42 yards out. It's still 0-0, and at this point, I think the advantage was clearly in the Chiefs' favor. The Chiefs' defense was great. The offense looked pretty good. Both teams traded special teams errors. Advantage Chiefs. Chiefs offense stalled, though, pretty much immediately after. I might have spoken too soon. The Chiefs offense looking okay. And then at MC Reach, King Reach, on Twitter pointed out that Reed hadn't run the ball very often, considering that the Chargers were missing two of their defensive linemen, which was a very, very good point. the Chiefs end up running the ball a little bit more, but never that effectively. Then on 3rd and 15, Smith draws the Chargers offsides, gets a free play, takes a shot downfield. Wilson comes down with it, and you could not have asked for a better play from Alex Smith there. That's one of the things that in the Packers game was so constantly talked about, is how good Aaron Rodgers is at drawing the defense offsides, understanding that he has a free play to do whatever he wants. No interception would matter because they get the ball back because of the penalty on the defense. But any deep play downfield, you can decline the penalty, obviously. That's something that Aaron Rodgers is so good at, and something that I've never really seen Alex Smith do before. And he did it here. Nice play downfield to Albert Wilson. Great play there. But then the very next play, the interception-free streak ended for Alex Smith. I believe it was 312 passes, second all-time behind Tom Brady, who had 358. And while I missed the streak immediately after Alex Smith's first interception in a very, very long time, there wasn't a better time to have it happen, or a better kind of interception to throw. One of the criticisms of Alex Smith, and usually a fair criticism of Alex Smith, is that he is too hesitant to go down the field with the ball. And in a lot of cases, it's because he doesn't have the best deep arm in the game. Although, like going back to when Joe Flacco was healthy, Alex Smith had more yards on less throws than Joe Flacco did. Had a better average yards per attempt than Joe Flacco. And Joe Flacco has a cannon. So I think Alex Smith has been very smart this year, and he's worked the offensive system absolutely to peak capability. But Alex Smith, one of the main criticisms is that he doesn't go down the field enough. And if you're going to go down the field and know that you have a chance of having it picked off, as every quarterback does, but I think Alex Smith might have a little bit higher of a chance of being intercepted because he's not throwing the ball with quite the same zip that some of the big cannon arm guys are. Well, Alex Smith throws the ball 40 yards down the field, and it's picked off at the 1 yard line. That is completely okay with me. If Alex Smith is going to throw it from his own 20, he's going to throw the ball 40 yards and have it picked off. You cannot do that because then the defense is getting the ball at the 40-yard line. Needs to go 60 yards for the touchdown. Whenever you take a shot from the 40-yard line on a play that is, I say, and this is not scientific, but say you're throwing the ball down to the 1 yard line, which is what happened. So you've got a 33% chance of it being a touchdown. A 30% chance of being a touchdown, a 30% chance of it being intercepted, and a 40% chance of it being incomplete. Those odds are okay with me most of the time, especially if you're 40 yards out. I have no problem with that decision. Obviously, I'd like to see a better throw there. The receiver has the advantage because he knows where the ball is supposed to be. Incompletions are more frequent than interceptions, but those are going to happen every once in a while. And in this stretch of over 300 passes, that was the first interception. I'm okay with that. And Smith has been more aggressive consistently in that streak. It's not like that was the first time. It's not like Alex Smith took 300 short passes and then went deep one time and got picked off. He had been doing that for several weeks, and we've been talking about that for several weeks. I'm okay with that. Don't freak out about Alex Smith's one interception. Again, the very Cliff's Notes version of what happened. The Chargers converted some third downs, and then on fourth down, Jay Howard jumped off sides, which is utterly inexcusable. I hate that, the jumping on a hard count. The Chargers had to use three timeouts to avoid delay of game penalties. Tom Bahali stopped a draw play whenever he recognized a tight end stunt that saved the Chiefs some big yardage. And then Rivers hit Danny Woodhead on 3rd and 7. Woodhead hauled it in with one hand. It was a great catch, but Ron Parker had a great play, read it perfectly, and dropped immediately. Frankie Hammond then had another mistake, let the punt drop and stop at the 4-yard line. Then three straight runs for the Chiefs. First down, Ware eats through the Chargers' front 7 in a beautiful run for 20. Macklin goes around the end for a loss of 2. West goes for 9. And then Smith kept a read option and went for the first down. 8 straight runs and 4 straight read options for the Chiefs in that time span. Those read options are going to be important, not only against teams like the Chargers, but against good teams and hopefully in the playoffs. The ability that Alex Smith has to do that and to be a threat to hand the ball off, to keep the ball and run, or to keep the ball and pass if you want to eventually bring in some more passing game and the read options, is very dangerous. And it's funny because it's kind of a college style. You don't expect an NFL team to be doing that. And you don't. And I know a lot of people don't see Alex Smith as being as mobile as he actually is, which I think most Chiefs fans understand now. But this is a very interesting dynamic for the Chiefs offense. Also, Doug Peterson, the offensive coordinator, has been doing a lot more play calling lately, which I think is something valuable to keep an eye on as the play calling has gotten better. So hopefully that all continues and the offense continues to have better play calls. But in this game, obviously, 10 points at the end of it, not a completely sharp offensive performance. And then Spencer Ware left the game with an injury at one point, and I was legitimately saying the phrase, you know, if Spencer Ware is seriously injured, it really hurts the Chiefs' playoff potential. And that is I would have said that sarcastically probably in week 5 when the Chiefs were 1-4 and Spencer Ware was not going to be part of the team. But that's a legitimate sentence now. And Ware might not be playing on Sunday. He's on the injury report, but he should be back in a couple of games at the absolute worst. And he came back in this game for some of it. He has a rib injury. So then Smith hits Albert Wilson on a quick slant. Wilson takes it for 44. Terez Paylor pointed out that the Chargers looked to be playing without a safety on that play, and Albert Wilson and Alex Smith exploited it, and it was a superb throw. Excellent execution all around. The route was perfect, the play call was perfect, the read was perfect, and the throw was perfect. And that capped a 96-yard touchdown run, or touchdown drive, with just under 2 minutes left in the half. The Chiefs went from that 4-yard down from Frankie Hammond, that punt that he should have fielded. And then it ends in the 44-yard Albert Wilson touchdown. The Chiefs go up 7-0 there. And then really superb pressure on Phillip Rivers by Jay Howard and Dee Ford. Marcus Peters makes a great play on the ball on the next drive. Tips it up in the air, and it's caught by Derek Johnson. A fantastic defensive play and the interception for DJ. Then Smith goes deep to Macklin for 21 yards. Then a few plays later, Alex Smith hangs out in the pocket for a little while, stays calm, scrambles for 18 yards, gets out of bounds, and Cairo Santos nails the field goal. The Chiefs go up 10-0, and then there was an accidental onside kick that didn't work as time expired. Or I guess it did work. The Chiefs recovered it, but it was like a squib kick gone wrong. But the Chiefs go into halftime up 10-0, and yes, it was the first time the Chargers were shut out in the first half since 2003 when the Chiefs shut them out. That was via the TV broadcast. I did not think the Chiefs were done scoring at this point. I was reasonably happy with 10 points considering it was 10-0, and I did not think the Chargers offense was going to be able to bounce back too much, but I certainly thought the Chiefs offense would perform better at home against a pretty lame defense, honestly. So I was surprised to see the Chiefs end with just these 10 points after the half. Then halftime comes and goes, and the Chiefs make some progress. And there, you could argue that they should have had another touchdown right here. They certainly should have had another 3 points. But I will argue they should have had another touchdown because the Chiefs drove, and then Smith got hit on third down on what should have been a first down to Kelce. But Kelce could not hold on to it. It looked like he was hearing footsteps out ahead of him coming to hit him. And you can't let that happen. I mean, I understand. This caused a whole new conversation about Travis Kelce on Twitter. And I'm surprised this is still a thing, honestly. But Travis Kelce obviously had the fumble last week. And then in this case, he should have caught the ball. I'm not sure he would have scored on it because of the defender out ahead of him. But he should have caught it. It should have been a first down. And the Chiefs drive should have ended up ending in a touchdown, even if he wasn't the one to score it there. He's got to hold on to the ball. But, you can't honestly tell me that Travis Kelce's not the best tight end on the team. That he's not one of the most important weapons on the team. He absolutely has to get his fumbling issues together, and he absolutely has to be able to catch those passes in the red zone. Those are hugely important things. And we also don't know why he struggles with them. People have been tweeting about maybe he just doesn't have a good enough head on his shoulders. Maybe he's not smart enough to do. I'm not entirely, legitimately, this is not even just me trying to poke around for reaction. I don't think I understand what being smart has to do with catching that football in the red zone. Or even what it has to do with holding on to a football and not fumbling it. You don't have to be on the honor roll to hold on to a football. And I don't know, and I'm not saying that Travis Kelce isn't. I don't know anything about Travis Kelce from like an academic perspective or how smart he is. I don't know Travis Kelce. I don't know. I'm just saying, I don't think it really matters. I think he understands that he needs to not fumble the football and that he needs to catch it in the red zone. But he hasn't been executing it enough. And in case you've forgotten, he does execute most of the time. He's currently the second leading receiver on the Chiefs. Second in receptions, second in targets, second in yards, second in receiving touchdowns, second in yards per game receiving. And he has 2 fumbles. And I understand. So, and Jeremy Maclin has 1. I don't know what you want. I don't know what he leads the team in yards after the catch by a large, large margin. He's one of the most talented tight ends in football. He needs to be able to catch those kinds of passes and needs to not fumble the ball. There we go. I don't know what other commentary I'm missing. Because I feel like every time I talk about Travis Kelce, someone wants to push back and say, "Well, no, you got to sit him down." No, if you sit him down, your offense goes from having one of the most talented young tight ends in football with some major flaws to having a totally forgettable set of tight ends and Demetrius Harris and Brian Parker. James O'Shaughnessy is on IR. What do you want? What is the plan? If you want to sit down Travis Kelce, okay, fine. I'll go ahead. Tell me what you want to have happen instead. Defenses, even when Travis Kelce has, I would argue that he's had a disappointing season on some level, even though he could still very well end with 1,000 yards. He's had a disappointing season. He's not lived up to the expectations we had, and he's had some big mistakes. But defenses still have to account for him because he is a dangerous football player. What do you want to do without Travis Kelce? You want to put Demetrius Harris and Brian Parker out there to run whatever routes Travis Kelce is running? I mean, be my guest. I'd rather not because right now the Chiefs have these receiving weapons. Okay, Jeremy Maclin, real receiving weapon. Albert Wilson, a number two receiver on a good day. Charkhandrick West, the third running back on this team before the season started, who is a threat out of the backfield, but he's not a superstar. And then what? Chris Conley? Chris Conley hasn't done anything this year. Chris Conley's been a dead man. Demetrius Harris, I have no faith in Demetrius Harris. Certainly not as much as I have in Travis Kelce. If you do, feel free to let me know why. I'd love to hear it. James O'Shaughnessy, who is on IR and hasn't played in a very long time, has more receiving yards than Demetrius Harris and Brian Parker combined. Anthony Sherman has more receiving yards than Brian Parker. Chris Conley has more receiving yards than Demetrius Harris. Again, as does James O'Shaughnessy, more than either of them combined. Jason Avant out has more receptions and more yards than any of those non-Travis Kelce tight ends. Demetrius Harris has 6 catches for 59 yards this year. Brian Parker has 1 for 6. If you don't think Travis Kelce is a king, fine. That's okay. You can believe that. You can question that. You can think about that. We can have that conversation. But he is the second receiving weapon on this team, and he has flaws. But if you sit him down, you're cutting off one of the arms of this offense, and I'm not willing to do that because he drops a couple of passes. Sorry, not even close. Then after that drop by Travis Kelce, the Chiefs miss the field goal. Low snap, bad hold, field goal no good. Then the Chargers drive, pick up the first down, a short pass to Gordon, another one to Malcolm Floyd after Rivers bought way too much time. 3rd and 5, Rivers had some time, went to scramble for the first down, but Dee Ford chased him down. They got a field goal. There it is, 10-3. Ended up being your final score. Spoiler alert. And then a would-be Charkhandrick West touchdown was undone back to Kelce by Kelce just knocking over a corner. They called it a pick play, and you have to be pretty aggressive to get called for a pick play in the NFL right now, and he did, and he was. And then Smith ends up taking a sack there. And if you had to bring the doesn't have the head for the game thing back in, fine, I guess. I mean, this makes more sense than after dropping a pass. And this is something that Kelce absolutely has to improve on. My previous points stand, and then Ben Almquist at Citadel Chief on Twitter, I thought, made a very good point in the Travis Kelce discussion. He said, Kelce is in desperate need of veteran mentorship. Anthony Fasano is sorely missed right now. And that's completely, I am totally on board with that. I think Anthony Fasano is overpaid and overrated as a player. But Travis Kelce needs someone in that tight end group that he can look up to, that he can be mentored by on some level. Demetrius Harris and Brian Parker are, Travis Kelce's not listening to either of them. He shouldn't be. He's so far, he's out of their league. It's not close. They're different animals. But Anthony Fasano, I do think, is missed in that case because Travis Kelce is the veteran of that group. He's the star and the veteran, and that's not working very well in cases where penalties and drops are happening. So maybe that's the way that those issues get resolved. The Chiefs don't have that right now, which is too bad. Back on defense, Dee Ford gets his first sack of the year, sprinting around the edge to get Rivers on 3rd and 20. Then 1st and 20, after a Ja Reed penalty, Smith was sacked thanks to a whiff from Ja Reed, who just got signed to a 3-year contract today, on Thursday, which is the strangest thing that's happened for the Chiefs in a while, I think. I'll talk about that a little bit after this. Then blah, 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 the Chiefs punt. And then the Chargers get to 3rd down, and Dee Ford gets right around to Phillip Rivers incredibly quickly. He was untouched. He blew off the line. And I mean, the offensive lineman, by the way, the tackle for the Chargers, who Dee Ford whipped on in the second half, is terrible. We'll get back to Dee Ford later. But Dee Ford gets to Rivers' blindside incredibly quickly. Chiefs converted on 3rd and 4 when they have the ball back with a 1st down to Travis Kelce. Travis Kelce, the second most important receiving weapon on the team. Then another, the next play, another first down, a slant to Albert Wilson. The Chiefs get a little bit going, but on 3rd and 9, Alex Smith has Travis Kelce short in space, but Eric Weddle did not let Kelce get away. Chiefs have to punt, and then start to get a little bit tense at this point. The Chargers get the ball back with 5 minutes left, down by 7 points. Danny Woodhead gets 3 yards. A sack by Jay Howard, who took an offensive lineman with him, an incredible push, helps the cause. Then Marcus Peters had a shot at an interception on Malcolm Floyd and absolutely should have broken up a pass, but Malcolm Floyd held on for 41 yards. Then D. Ford scooped up his 3rd sack of the day on the next play. Then on 4th and 3, each team traded timeouts. Then Rivers absolutely threaded a short pass across the middle for a first down. And then a pattern formed for the Chargers. 1st and 10, incomplete. 2nd and 10, incomplete deep. 3rd and 10, D. Ford pressure, incomplete. 4th and 10, Rivers to Gates for 16. 1st and 10, Ford chases Rivers out, incomplete. 2nd and 10, Floyd plows through defensive back, incomplete. 3rd and 10, Tomba pressure. Gates could have probably been called for offensive pass interference, but I think both of those plays were clean. And then 4th and 10 again. 20 seconds left. 22-yard pass to the 1. D. Ford was running after that play to get back on the right side of the ball, but he could not get back in time. Chargers snap it half the distance to the goal. 5 seconds left for the Chargers to get half of a yard to tie the game. And I think the Chargers would have probably gone for 2 had they gotten the touchdown, and that would have terrified me. Then the Chargers get a delay of game, a 5-yard penalty. They move back 5 yards. Then Rivers leads Green by just a little bit too much. A false start on San Diego. They move back 5 more yards. And then the last play of the game with D. Ford in coverage, Rivers hit Danny Woodhead in the end zone, but Woodhead could not hold on, and the Chiefs win the game 10-3. I hope everyone saw the Bears game happening again here, because that's certainly what I saw as this game was unfolding in that last drive. The Chiefs defense held the Chargers to 3 points, and if it would have ended up being 10 points, you wouldn't have heard me crushing them today. The Chiefs defense did what they needed to, and much more. It was the Bears game. This game was the Bears game with a different result. And sloppy is fine. It's a results business for the Chiefs and for the NFL. It's a results business. Sloppy counts. And the defense, though, did their job regardless of the ending of that last drive. If the Chiefs give up 3 points or 10 points, they held up their end of the bargain. It was the offense that would have lost the game, although it would have looked like the defense. And I feel the same way with the Bears game. Offensively, Alex Smith goes for under 200 yards, a touchdown and a pick. The team runs for 150 yards, 50 for West, 50 for Ware, 40 for Smith. The receiving game was basically Albert Wilson's long pass. Macklin goes 6 for 68, Wilson 4 for 89 or 4 for 87. Travis Kelce, 3 for 18. Demetrius Harris, 2 for 18. See, Demetrius Harris is clearly better. But I stand by, this was how the Bears game looked with a different result. It was 18-17. The Chiefs lost on that final drive. The Bears scored 12 points in the fourth quarter. This would have looked the same way to me. This would have been the same deal where the Chiefs defense gave up 18 points at home against the Bears. Against a bad defense, the offense should have done better. And they obviously lost Jamal Charles in that game, which shook up the defense, shook up the offense. But it shouldn't have taken it up that much. The Chiefs' offense was better than that, or should have been better than that. The Chiefs felt a 1-4 after that game, and the season felt over. I would have called it over. The Chiefs were 10-point favorites and ended up losing by 1 in the fourth quarter. This game was the same, except for it went to the Chiefs. It went to the Chiefs' way. And if that exact play happens 10 times, and Danny Woodhead is in that exact position 10 times, he probably catches that 30% or 40% of the time. Not quite half, but enough to go, oh dear, this could have been it. This could have been a Chiefs loss to not necessarily derail the season, but make the playoffs a whole lot more complicated, or at least a whole lot more nerve-wracking to get to. But it worked out. Sloppy counts. However, this is not good enough for the playoffs. A sloppy victory is still a victory. If the Chiefs win a 10-3 game in the playoffs, I will not complain the next day. But if this team is what shows up in Indianapolis, in Houston, wherever, in Jacksonville, maybe, wherever the Chiefs would play, maybe at home, maybe they win the division. I'll talk about that in a little bit. Wherever this Chiefs team plays, if they play a playoff caliber team, this kind of game is not going to be good enough. If the result is a victory, I'll be happy. But playing like this will not get them that. And so I think there's something to be said about the Chiefs winning this game and Chiefs teams of the past not being able to win this kind of game. Even Chiefs teams of Week 5 losing this game to the Bears. I agree with that. I think it's something to be said there. I think the Chiefs, for many of the last, I don't know, 5 years, don't win this game. They lose it at the end. They don't get the field goal earlier. Whatever. I don't see this team winning from years past in a game like this. This is the kind of game the Chiefs have gotten used to losing. And this year, for the last 7 weeks, the Chiefs have found different ways to win every week. I think that's very important. It's a results business. But this is not good enough. This is not going to work long term. Is it good enough against the Ravens this week? I think it will be. Will it be good enough against the Browns? Yeah. Will it be good enough against the Raiders? Probably not. Maybe. If Khalil Mack decides to turn on the afterburners again, the Chiefs play like this, they'll lose to the Raiders in Week 17. Scare us all about the playoffs a little bit. If they are in a playoff game against a playoff team, is this kind of game going to be good enough? No. No, it won't be. So the Chiefs have a lot of things from this game that they need to address. They need to not let themselves be stuck at 10 points against a bad defense again. But if you zoom out a little bit, the ultimate result is obviously fantastic. It's the 7th straight victory from a team that we wanted to bury back in Week 6. Before we jump into some other points, notes, things to take away from this victory, I want to talk about Patreon for a second, and then we'll talk about Dee Ford, where the Chiefs are now, Justin Houston's knee, Ja Reed, all kinds of great stuff, so just buckle up. But Patreon.com, Patreon.com, is a tipping and reward site, a donation site, however you want to look at it. It helps financially support creators of content. And in this case, it's me and this show. Patreon.com/RTK. You can set up a monthly pledge where you can throw a little bit of money in my general direction. Things so far that money has gone to is this beautiful new microphone that I've been using for a couple of shows now. A Blue Yeti microphone that I got on Black Friday. Plus, maybe more importantly, it's covered my iTunes hosting package, so more people can listen to the show through iTunes, and also subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave reviews if you like the show. That helps people know that this is something that they should be listening to, and if you subscribe on iTunes, you get every episode as soon as it comes out, and you will never miss one. So subscribing on iTunes is the best way to make sure you're always on top of this show, because sometimes it takes a little longer for it to get out on Arrowhead Addict. We're almost to the point of having $100 pledged for the month of December, which is fantastic. I did not even expect to get that far within this season because I started partway through the year. So I cannot say thank you enough for that. And then specifically to these people, the $20 group is Don Beal at DonBeal32 on Twitter, Andy Simpson, Steven Smith, and Derek Vaughn at D_Vaughn88 on Twitter. And then the two veterans from the $10 group, Christine Roadlander at C Roadlander and Ty DeClaire at TyDeClaire44. Both of those are their Twitter handles. I thank you guys so much. Plus Josh Beadle and Ben Rahman in the $5 group. Thank you all so much for supporting this show for multiple months. Some of you brand new to the Patreon. I cannot thank you enough for supporting this show. I am hopefully and almost certainly, depending on how long the Chiefs are in the playoffs, going to go at least 2 shows a week during the Chiefs playoff run, however long that may be. Maybe we're looking at a Monday and a Thursday show, Monday and Friday, Tuesday and Thursday, I'm not sure yet. But I'm going to try to do more of this as the Chiefs playoff run ramps up, hopefully continues all the way into the month of February, if we all get a little lucky. But so thank you all again, patreon.com/RTK. You can support the show there in the biggest way. You can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JBBriscoe, facebook.com/RTKshow. You can like the page and send longer Facebook messages there, or you can always just tweet me questions, ideas, and anything you want on Twitter at JBBriscoe, as Ty DeClaire and Christine Roadlander did earlier today with that Eric Berry thing. I saw the Eric Berry mention in the Comeback Player of the Year story, but I didn't think about bringing it onto the show for whatever reason, so I'm very, very glad that they helped me realize that that's something that should be on the show, and I hope everyone feels like they can do that now. Anytime something like that comes up and you think I need to focus in and do that, I would love to be able to take on more special topics like that on this show. Now, Dee Ford. I have been surprised by the general consensus narrative on Dee Ford's game against the Chargers. Let's start with Sean Smith, the cornerback for the Chiefs. He's had on Dee Ford's monster game of 7 tackles, also tackles, 3 sacks, and then the breakup at the end of the game on that last pass. Quote, words can't explain how happy I am for him. His total stat line, this from Chris Simbauer on Twitter, 7 solo tackles, 3 sacks, 5 quarterback pressures, 3 quarterback hits, 1 pass defended. I'm happy for Dee Ford too, and I'm glad that he looked pretty good in this game. It was not a flawless game, and I'm really ready for Justin Houston to be back, because Dee Ford is not the pass defender that Justin Houston is, although not that Justin Houston should be defending the pass very often. But Dee Ford is a weapon on obvious passing downs, but he still has a hard time turning the corner. He has a hard time sometimes beating talented tackles, and he has a hard time in the run game, and run defense. Dee Ford was on the good side of one of the worst days of left tackle playing I've ever seen. It was a constant whipping, and he might be able to do that again on Sunday. At Ben Hillman on Twitter pointed out today that Dee Ford will either be facing the injured left tackle for the Ravens on Sunday or his replacement. So Dee Ford might have another good game, but and also Dee Ford's speed off the line was superb in this game, but he was not even going against an average left tackle, average blocking. He wasn't getting help from the tight end. Dee Ford had every advantage talent-wise, and he took advantage of that. And I'm glad he did. It was a good game for Dee Ford. I think she showed some flashes, and I think eventually we'll see a more fair representation of what he actually is, because I think for the most part, Chiefs fans have two images of him now, one of which is him running away from Frank Gore last year and just running away from him. And last week, which is 3 sacks, oh, he's Derek Thomas. And he's somewhere in between. He's not going to have 3 sacks a game. Duh, I know, I exaggerate. He's not that good. And he's not as bad as we saw last year. And hopefully he finds a consistent space in the middle where he's a legitimate number 2 pass rusher, so we can have Tom Bahaly retire whenever that ends up happening, if it's at the end of this year or another season. And then have him across from Justin Houston and go, this is a pass rushing duo that really matters. I don't think Dee Ford's ever going to be a number 1 pass rusher in the NFL, and this game did not affect that for me. But I think he certainly has some very valuable tools. He had a very nice game against a very bad offensive lineman. Okay, that's okay. He doesn't have to. The overreaction with Dee Ford, I think, has just been a little bit insane, and partially because he's a first-round pick. But on both sides, the overreaction has gone too far. Come back to the middle a little bit on Dee Ford. Let's see if he can prove it a few more times. I think it's possible. I think it's possible we see him develop into a nice player. But he's not going to be a Hall of Famer, and he's not going to be completely incompetent like we saw last year. Come back to the middle a little bit on Dee Ford. Let's appreciate his highlights. Let's forgive his lowlights and see where he ends up actually being in a couple of games. The Denver Broncos are 10-3. The Kansas City Chiefs are 8-5, and the Chiefs would have a tiebreaker if they need to be tie broken. And the reason that might happen would be for the AFC West division title. And this surprises me on a few different levels. But first, let me explain what just happened and then what would need to happen for the Chiefs in this situation. Last week, the Broncos lost at home against the Oakland Raiders 15-12. Khalil Mack had a huge day. And then now the Broncos will go to Pittsburgh, then have the Bengals at home, then the Chargers at home. I think the Broncos will lose in Pittsburgh this week. I think they'll win the other two games. But if they lose to A.J. McCarron and the Bengals, because Andy Dalton is hurt, if they lose to A.J. McCarron and the Bengals at home and the Chiefs win out, the Chiefs will take the division. And here's why that might happen. Although we've liked to sarcastically peg the Brock Osweiler era as being on its way, Osweiler has struggled a little bit, as has the Broncos offense, which struggled, though, even more with Peyton Manning. From Gil Brandt on Twitter, since Osweiler took over the starting job in Week 11, Denver has had the NFL's most 3-and-outs, 18, and the Broncos have not reached the end zone on their last 23 drives. Again, I think the Steelers will beat the Broncos, and then it will become a matter of the Chiefs have to win out, and the Broncos have to fall in one of their last two games at home. If the Bears could close out against the Broncos, we'd be talking about the Chiefs having probably taking the division title, possibly being the favorite to take the AFC West, but I don't think it will happen, but that's what, now you know, that's what it will take, and it's certainly at least a possibility. Speaking of possibility, Justin Houston's possibility of returning got really dark for a day or so when he visited Dr. James Andrews, and everybody freaked out. At Rand Getlin on Twitter posted, quote, "I'm told that Chiefs linebacker Justin Houston was set to visit Dr. Andrews regarding his knee. Some fear him that he'll miss the rest of the regular season." Then Therese Paylor tweeted later, "Chiefs trainer Rick Burkholder said Justin Houston got a second opinion from Dr. Andrews, which the Chiefs supported, hyperextended knee." Then Adam Teicher wrote for ESPN.com, "Justin Houston's rehab from a hyperextended knee is going well, and his visit to noted orthopedic surgeon Dr. James Andrews is not a sign that his injury is more serious than initially feared," Kansas City Chiefs trainer Rick Burkholder said. That's good news. That's pretty much status quo. And frankly, the Chiefs, I'm not worried about Justin Houston for the Ravens game. I'm not that worried about Justin Houston for the Browns game. It would be great to have him back for the Raiders game at home. And then obviously, he needs to be a part of the Chiefs playoff run if there's going to be a playoff run. Another interesting topic whenever I ask for what else should we be talking about on this show, at Rolex03_AL on Twitter asked it for me to talk about concussions on the Chiefs like D'Anthony Thomas, Hussein Abdullah, and Mike DeVito. Now, DeVito has returned to practice, as has Jeff Allen. But where I think I want to take this discussion, because I don't know more about concussions than your average non-doctor NFL fan, I think. It's they're very difficult to deal with, and I think that is what we need to talk about when we talk about concussions. It feels like D'Anthony Thomas has been out for about 6 months. It's been since week 11. But it feels like he's been out for a very, very long time with his concussion. Mitch Morse, we were talking about a head and neck injury. Eric Fisher, neck injury. Hussein Abdullah has been out for a little while. I can't tell you about the specifics of a concussion in a way that a doctor could, so obviously that's what you're looking for. You're going to need to go elsewhere. But I think what we can do is look at the Chiefs and how the Chiefs have been dealing with losing those two guys and not knowing when they're going to be back. I'm a little less concerned about Hussein Abdullah in some way, although maybe we shouldn't be, because I think we saw some shortcomings in the secondary without him lately. And Tyvon Branch has played pretty well. Ron Parker's been playing a lot of slot because Phil Gaines is on IR, and Steven Nelson is not getting on the field, and Jamel Fleming and Marcus Cooper should not be getting on the field. So Ron Parker's been playing a lot of the slot, which actually surprises me that's been working so well. Ron Parker's been spectacular for the Chiefs in an unnatural position for him. But with Tyvon Branch playing some without Abdullah, we've seen more Daniel Sorensen, which is not ideal. So I would love to see Abdullah be back as soon as possible, but that's what the Chiefs have to do until he is ready to go again. And similarly to Justin Houston, I'm not concerned about not having guys for the Ravens and Browns games. The Chiefs should be able to take care of business there anyway. But for the Raiders game, not only because they need to win that game, and that's a difficult game because the Raiders are a good football team, but at least up to that point, I think Branch and even Daniel Sorensen can fill that hole. I've missed D'Anthony Thomas so much. I am so tired of watching Frankie Hammond Jr. muff punts, make poor fielding decisions, and not being able to trust his hands. I'd almost rather see Jeremy Maclin back there for the most part, even if it's just saying, fair catch it, catch the ball, stand there, and then we'll go play offense. Frankie Hammond terrifies me. I do not want to see Frankie Hammond return a punt in a playoff game. I don't want that at all. But at this point, maybe it happens because D'Anthony Thomas has been out much longer than we thought he would be. So that's how the concussions are affecting the Chiefs right now. Thankfully, it is just down to those two guys. Morse is back. Allen is back. DeVito is back to practice. Alan Bailey has returned. So the injuries are starting to dissipate a little bit for the Chiefs. In fact, let's go ahead and look at the injury report as we start to look towards the Ravens game here. Spencer Ware is questionable right now. He missed practice on Thursday with a rib injury. Justin Houston, we talked about, still considered day-to-day after the hyperextended knee confirmation from James Andrews. D'Anthony Thomas, still in the NFL's concussion protocol, which we don't know very much about on a day-to-day basis. And those are the big injuries for the Chiefs right now. And now into what I believe is our last side topic here for this show before we get into the Ravens-Chiefs preview or prediction or whatever that will end up actually looking like. Ja Reed is getting paid. Ja Reed's getting paid pretty well by the Kansas City Chiefs. He just signed a 3-year extension, much to my surprise. It is a 3-year extension worth $10.2 million, has a chance to make $12 million with under $4 million in guarantees. So it's not a crazy contract. $4 million in guaranteed money is not completely insane. Matt Connor, at Matt Connor AP, tweeted, Ja Reed at 3 years likely replaces Paul Fanica's 3-year contract in what will become known as, quote, John Dorsey's annual weird offensive line spend. And I have a hard time fighting that. The Fanica thing did not work, and he's on IR, partially because I think he wasn't good, and the Chiefs had more guards than they needed at the time. But Ja Reed, I suppose if you think of him as the swing tackle for the future, this is fine. I think Eric Fisher's coming into his own. I think Donald Stevenson, I think Andy Reid is done with Donald Stevenson. And so maybe you think of Ja Reed as being Donald Stevenson next year. But I don't think Ja Reed is as good as the good Donald Stevenson we've seen. He might be better than bad Donald Stevenson, but I don't think he's better than good Donald Stevenson. Pro Football Focus ranks every offensive tackle in football and had Ja Reed at the fifth worst, which is, if there's more to that than just whatever you can measure with Pro Football Focus numbers. I get it. But woof, I don't, it's not a ton of money, and if there's something that the Chiefs like, I'm okay with it, as long as this isn't a long-term right tackle shot, because Ja Reed is not that. He can be a swing tackle. He can be maybe your third, ideally your fourth best tackle. But your fourth best tackle is usually a project, usually a guy that you're moving from practice squad back and forth or trying to really develop. And Ja Reed's not that. He's not going to get better. This is him. So I guess as a third tackle, as a swing tackle in a league where it's hard to get consistent offensive linemen, I guess that's okay. But I feel like he makes a lot of mistakes, not just holding or being offsides or false start or whatever, but in the actual, like, down-to-down passing game. So this confused me a little bit by the Chiefs to extend Ja Reed by 3 years. It's not a terrible signing. I'm not weeping and gnashing my teeth, but it was a little bit confusing for me. All right, now let's get to the actual game coming up on Sunday. The Kansas City Chiefs will be going to Baltimore to take on the Baltimore Ravens. The Ravens, who according to Trey Wingo, have 40% of their salary cap currently sitting on injured reserve. I know the Chiefs won't have Justin Houston in this game, or DeAnthony Thomas, or Hussein Abdullah in all likelihood. I just don't think it matters. Not only do they not have Justin Forsett, they don't have their quarterback. They don't have Joe Flacco. They might not have Matt Schaub. Matt Schaub is currently listed as probable for this game, but Jimmy Clausen started last week against the Seahawks. And then they signed Ryan Mallett. If any of those quarterbacks, one of those quarterbacks will start, and I was about to say if any of those quarterbacks start, the Chiefs will win. One of them will start, and the Chiefs will win this game. There's nothing here that I'm afraid of with the Ravens. They're 3-8, and they have none of their weapons back. If you open up their depth chart, which I'll do now, and just look at their skill position guys, Kamar Aiken is, I know who he is just based off of necessity, based off of the idea that in fantasy football, someone has to catch the ball for the Ravens, because Steve Smith is gone as well. So, Kamar Aiken and Marlon Brown are currently listed as their top two receivers on the rlads.com depth chart for the Ravens. I've heard of Chris Givens. I've heard of Jeremy Butler. I'm not afraid of any of them. And then, as I mentioned earlier, Dee Ford's going to be going up either against the backup Ravens left tackle or an injured one. Their offensive line is banged up. Matt Schaub is probably starting. If not Matt Schaub, Jimmy Clausen. If not Jimmy Clausen, Ryan Mallett. Terrence West is their other running back right now, along with Javorius Allen, who's run pretty well in Justin Forsett's stead, but nothing insane, and not as well last week against the Seahawks. He really struggled. And their defense is not the Baltimore Ravens defense. Don't freak out when you hear Baltimore Ravens and defense in the same sentence right now. And since the Ravens lost Joe Flacco in a victory over the Rams, that's when Joe Flacco got injured. After that, they won that crazy game against the Browns, whenever in Cleveland, winning on a blocked field goal returned for a touchdown. Crazy game. And then the last 2 weeks, they've lost both of them. They lost to the Dolphins 15-3 and to the Seahawks 35-6. That's 19 points in those two games, not counting playing the Browns. I am not concerned. I don't fear this team. Holding the Dolphins to 15 points makes your ears perk up a tiny bit and go, well, the Dolphins have some players. Pardon my indifference, I suppose, on what the Ravens bring to the table. I've never ended up on this page on ESPN, but they have a list of how a team's power rankings have changed through the year, and their power rankings are obviously completely arbitrary, but it's kind of interesting to see. In the preseason, the Ravens were at 7, week 1 they were at 8, now they're at 29. They fell all the way into the low 20s, even with Joe Flacco. By week 9, they were at 27. They're at 28 in week 7. They also started 1-5, but they have not rebounded like the Chiefs have. I think the Chiefs beat the Ravens, even on the road against a team that's historically difficult to beat. I think the Chiefs win this game like pretty comfortably. Macklin and Smith will connect just enough. The run game, I think, will run over the Ravens. The Chiefs defense should hold up entirely against whatever quarterback shows up. I don't think the Chiefs are going to have to score three touchdowns to win this game, but I think they will. I think this is a 27-10 kind of game. And I hate picking blowout predictions in the NFL because it can make you look stupid really quickly. Because, yes, of course, the Ravens could win this game. If they play this game 100 times, the Ravens win, I don't know, 25 of them. Maybe 20. The Ravens aren't completely incompetent, but I don't think they're going to win. And if I have to bet my life on it, I think the line right now is 8 points. I would take the Chiefs and give the points in this matchup. I think the Chiefs are that much better, and it's nice to be able to say that again. But again, especially without knowing who their quarterback is even going to be, I don't care if it's Matt Schaub or Jimmy Clausen or Ryan Mallett. None of those guys are beating the Chiefs, not even on the road. That's going to do it for this episode of Roughing the Kicker on Arrowhead Addict Radio, arrowheadaddict.com. I'm your host, Joshua Briscoe, at JB Briscoe on Twitter. You can get in contact with me there or on Facebook at facebook.com/RTK Show. Patreon.com/RTK is the best way to help this show financially. But subscribe to the show on iTunes. Never miss an episode. Leave a review on iTunes so people can see that they like it. Share the show with your friends, family, coworkers, people you don't like that much but are Chiefs fans. I'll pretty much leave that up to you. But as always, thank you for listening. And not only just for listening, but for participating in the show. For the feedback, for the back and forth, and even just for every once in a while, say, hey, I'm listening to the show from the middle of California. I like to be able to provide some red in Raider Nation, or some red in Brazil, or in San Antonio, wherever it may be. As always, no matter where you are, thank you for listening to the Roughing the Kicker podcast. I'll be back next week after the Chiefs, I don't know, step on the Ravens' head or something. At this point, I'm way overly confident in what the Chiefs are going to do. I think it's pretty much a guaranteed Super Bowl win. Too soon?